You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review for the week of February 8th through the 14th. I'm Sarah Custer, and joining me is our news editor, Chris Havergal, our data editor, Simon Baker, and acting deputy news editor, Ellie Bothwell. Hi, everyone.
Hi,
how are you?
Checking your work email while on holiday, squeezing in a few hours over the weekend to finish a report, sound familiar? We all know how our jobs can bleed into our personal lives, but a global survey by Times Higher Education shows just how off-kilter the work-life balance is for academics and university staff. Ellie will tell us more about the findings on that later. Also, UCAS statistics this week show a shift towards recruiting more mature students at UK universities. Simon will analyze the figures for us, as well as explain how it's not just the University of Oxford that might be showing signs of elitism in the city of Oxford itself. And speaking of elitism, protests have erupted in France against reforms of the high school baccalaureate, which could make universities more selective. Chris will have the latest in a moment, but first, Ellie, the survey of academics and university staff really covers all aspects of academics' lives in the work-life balance, including childcare, friendships, intimate relationships. What was the methodology behind this? How did you come to do this survey?
Yeah, so it was an online survey that was filled in by more than 2,000 academics and professional staff. The vast majority were academics, about 85%. And yeah, it basically covered kind of all of those areas that you just mentioned then. I mean, it is a self-selecting survey, so you do sometimes tend to get, you know, respondents from the kind of more extreme points of view. But, you know, given the fact that it was about 2,300 responses, it was still kind of makes for very interesting reading.
And what were some of the most impactful conclusions, or what stood out to you the most?
Yeah, I mean, the overall sort of kind of headline finding is basically that most university staff, and that's academics and professional staff, think they're overworked and underpaid, which might not be surprising, but also that their careers have really quite a detrimental impact on the relationships they have with their friends, their families, their partners. We could see that female staff often felt the strain more than men in several of these areas. So 43% of female academics who have children, for instance, said that this holds back their career significantly or a great deal. That compared with just 25% of male academics. And the majority of scholars overall, about 58%, said their job restricts a lot or a reasonable amount their ability to see their friends as often as they would like. And a significant proportion of academics who don't have a partner said that their job gets in the way of their ability to conduct a successful relationship. So yeah, it really kind of shows how, you know, working in a university can have quite a serious impact on the relationships you have outside.
And was there much of a difference in the survey results between university staff and academics?
Yeah, so there were quite a large difference in some areas. I mean, overall, professional staff were generally much more content than academics. Generally, professional staff don't work as many hours. They don't think that their job impacts their personal life as much. Scholars were also twice as likely to say that they're sort of frequently consider switching careers. So about 16% of academics said that, compared to 8% of professional staff. But obviously that doesn't mean that professional staff don't have issues as well, that there were some, you know, quite shocking findings from them as well.
Well, you can read more about those findings on page 34 of this week's magazine, and also on our Times Higher Education website. Now, Simon, you look at the latest UCAS statistics of student recruitment in the UK. What do the figures show?
So UCAS, around this time of year, it publishes its kind of latest statistics on recruitment for the last cycle. So this was kind of students who started university in the autumn, as well as kind of recently some stats about new applications for this year have come out as well. But the data I looked at specifically this week was for those that started in the autumn. And you know, usually we sort of have seen over the last few years a kind of a bit of a pattern for some modern universities just recruiting a lot less 18-year-olds.
And modern being
post-92. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking about those that kind of, a lot of the universities that became universities after being polytechnics before 1992. So that since kind of higher fees came in, some of these universities have dropped by you know, something up to 50 or 60% in the number of 18-year-olds that are recruiting. But what's really interesting when you look sort of behind those figures is if you compare that with the number of mature students, those aged 21 and over, that they're recruiting. Some universities have clearly switched between the two and are focusing on them more. So they, if you look at their overall drop, or in some cases they haven't dropped at all, then it's kind of balanced out. And there's some really interesting sort of figures if you look at some of these universities. So for instance, Bedfordshire University now, I think last year recruited more older students than it did 18-year-olds. If you look at it's dropped by almost 60% in the number of 18-year-olds since 2012, but has gone up by almost 60% in the number of mature students. Other universities, though, haven't done the same thing. So you can look at the figures for, say, Kingston University in London or London Met, and they've dropped in both age groups. So overall, they're kind of, you know, seeing a sort of downturn. But it's just quite interesting how some universities seem to have deliberately taken that path and so, and others haven't. Likewise, kind of, you'll see more modern universities have kind of gone towards students that don't have A-levels or have done more vocational qualifications like BTECs, because there's been a general trend for that, more for more students to hold those. And it is the more modern universities that seem to be accepting them.
Hmm. And this, of course, touches on the issue of elitism, which was something that was brought up by David Lammy, a former Minister for Higher Education last year, who criticized Oxbridge universities for the elitism of their admissions process. And you've analyzed some more statistics this week showing that it might not just be the University of Oxford in the city which is having problems with elitism.
Yeah, that's right. It's a thing about UK higher education is that you get new statistics come out every week. So you're never short of any. But last week, some sort of annual stats that show how many state school students universities are taking came out. And this is something that kind of generally for the mainstream media becomes a bit of a big sort of story all the time, is like how many state school students are going to university. And then there's often complaints that if Oxford or Cambridge start taking too many state school children, then they must be dumbing down somehow to do that, you know. And this is just a constant row about it. But what was interesting is if you look at state school recruitment for the latest year, then you know the usual kind of suspects, if you like, are there in terms of those that have the smallest proportion of students from state schools. So that's Oxford, Cambridge, some other Russell Group universities like Bristol, Durham, have very small proportions of state school students, around kind of 50, 60 sort of percent, which is quite, when you compare that with the general population, is pretty low. But actually, the Higher Education Statistics Agency also publishes benchmark figures showing where you'd expect those universities to be if you take into account the qualification students hold, because you know that sort of is another factor that's quite important. And what's interesting, if you look at the distance in from benchmark, then Oxford Brookes University, not Oxford, actually is the furthest from that benchmark in the whole country. And we've sort of done it by statistical analysis, looking at sort of the proper distance that you should measure in terms of statistics. And they came out top. Bristol was the next worst, then Edinburgh. I mean, it's mostly Russell Group universities, but Oxford Brookes, obviously not. It's a modern university.
Hmm.
Quite interesting that it's got a work, you know, it's not as bad as Oxford in terms of its performance if you look at its benchmark.
Hmm, so maybe not so much the coincidence there. Well, you can read more about Simon's analysis of the Oxfords on page 9 of the magazine this week, and more on the UCAS statistics on page 20, and of course on timeshighereducation.com. Now, elitism was something else that was spurring protests in France this week. Chris, what's happening? What are the complaints about?
So you've got strikes and blockades on French campuses, unions and students who are concerned about reforms to the French baccalaureate, the university entrance exam. Change in French politics in French higher education is traditionally hard to achieve. You've now got a president in France, Emmanuel Macron, who clearly does have a mandate to deliver change. And he's looking to do that in higher education, as he is in many other areas of French society, you know, workers' rights and so on. on the baccalaureate, the sort of specific changes that are, that are proposed, really about making it much more specialised. You know, there's a view that the sort of general qualification that there is at the moment doesn't really prepare young people for university and the job market. So the idea is that you would make students specialise in two major and two minor subjects, which would sort of lead them, you know, more naturally into university level study, it's hoped. But you know, I've referenced the difficulties of achieving change in France. You've had these protests over the last week. I mean, the particular concerns of the unions are around whether this will lead to an increase in selectivity in French universities, if this is a way of sort of sifting through students. The union's case is that it's a way for the government to avoid having to bankroll a massive expansion of the sector, which is being driven by sort of a demographic bulge in the French population. I mean, equally, there's a concern for the unions that poorer students will lose out. Not every baccalaureate option in terms of the subjects you can specialise in will be available in every school. So students could find themselves shut out of particular degree courses much sooner than planned. And there's a broader argument over, something that we're perhaps, familiar doing in the UK, but in France there's definitely a question about whether at the age of sort of, 14 or 15, you should be taking these decisions which can shape your life chances later on. So, it perhaps reflects what's happening across the rest of Macron's France. You know, when you take on these things which are passionately held by some people, be it sort of working rights, be it the egalitarianism of their university system, you're never to be able to face challenges, and it'll be interesting to see whether Macron's mandate does hold out for him to be able to push them through.
And you can find more on that news story by David Matthews on page 11 of the magazine. Now, there is one university that is holding President Macron in quite high regard, Sciences Po. Chris, what's happening there?
Yeah, so they are Macron, the president's alma mater. He was a student there and indeed was also a visiting lecturer there. And Sciences Po is sort of experiencing what you might call the Macron bounce. They've had an increase in international applications of around 60% this year. The head of the institution, Frédéric Mion, who spoke to Jack Grove for this week's magazine, is saying he's sort of no doubt that this is caused by what he calls the Macron effect. Obviously a big part of the new president's agenda has been around sort of openness to the world, be it in terms of attracting international scientists, trying to attract international business, taking a global lead on issues like climate change, for example. So maybe that sort of prominence that he's given the country and the sort of agenda he's set out has helped. And, you wouldn't be surprised in that case that the institution where he studied, not all that long ago, given that he's a pretty young head of state, as heads of state go, enjoys the bulk of that boom. I mean, I guess it raises a broader sort of point. Sciences Po is quite different to the typical French university. I mean, just for a start, in terms of its international versus domestic student base, it's got around half of its students coming from abroad. One consequence of that is that it's much more financially autonomous than the rest of French higher education, which typically relies on the state for a bulk of its income.
And it's based in Paris, right? So are they going to have space to accept all 60% of the surge in international?
Well, I mean, I think it's sort of they're viewing it as a nice problem for them to have. They clearly don't have the scope to increase their size that much. I mean, one of the things they are doing, which is covered in the interview, is moving on to a new campus, a 14,000 square metre former Dominican convent, which was formerly occupied by the Ministry of the Armed Forces, which, they're very much hoping is going to become one of those sort of famous city centre campuses. But, that's more about consolidating, their existing sites and sort of bringing everything onto one site rather than significantly expanding their student numbers. Nevertheless, that sort of shows what they can do with the sort of financial autonomy that they have. So it will be interesting to see whether as Macron gets sort of further down the road of reforming French higher education, whether he pushes more universities in that direction.
Well, you can find out more about that on page 14 of the magazine. And of course, all of our great content is online at timeshighereducation.com. That's all for this week. Thanks for joining me. See you next week for the issue review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.